Blog Talk Radio.
Carol the Coach. Sex, love, and relationships. We talk about it here.
Carol the Coach. Compassion with contemporary relevance.
I am a psychotherapist. I can be your personal life coach, and I can help you with your issues. There are no problems too small or too big. You can talk about anything.
Speaker, columnist, radio TV host, and commentator. Carol the Coach brings messages of wellness and empowerment within reach of everyday people every day.
Almost 5 years ago, I lost my soulmate in an accident. He was killed in a plane crash. Life just for me has seemed to stop.
There are groups all over the city. I mean, I teach one. It is a specific way to start thinking so that you shift how you see the world, which then shifts your energy, and then you feel better and you actually see things differently.
Carol the Coach. Always available to at carolthecoach.com.
Now, I've got Russell on the line.
I'm 47 years old. I'm a truck driver. I am married. I have a wife in San Francisco.
Okay.
I haven't been home in 6 months. My thing is, I don't know if I have a sex addiction or what the problem is. Why do I want what I can't have? And as soon as I can have it, I don't want it anymore.
You're right on target when you say, I don't know if I have a sexual addiction. Well, guess what? Yes, you do. And you know what? That's my specialty, Russell. So you're at the right place. Continue.
I meet women online, and I'm in a different part of the country. I travel all 48 states, so I love sex.
I hear self-esteem issues. You never felt good enough, and you didn't feel like you were getting what you should have then, and you're reenacting that now. Do you want to change that about yourself?
Well, you know, I've got an interesting situation in that I have been working with sex addicts for over 5 years. Hi, I'm Carol the Coach, and I have devoted my show, This Life, to helping people with sexual addiction and their partners get healthy, know that there is recovery, and that they can mend and heal the wounds that have accompanied this very debilitating illness. I mean, a lot of people will say sexual addiction is not an illness, but I'm here to tell you that the addiction itself presents itself in such a way that clearly there's an obsession, there's a compulsion with it. It's what we call a process addiction. You know, everybody needs human touch. They want to feel needed. They want to be in a relationship. And 3/4 of sexual addiction is about connecting with that arousal template in the brain that lights up to provide that sense of excitement and that rush and that thrill, followed by huge levels of shame and guilt and self-loathing and hate. And, you know, that kind of auto-exacerbating behavior is very similar to being addicted to drugs or alcohol. Hi, this is Carol Jurgensen-Sheets. I am known as Carol the Coach. And for some of you that may be listening for the first time, this is a show where we explore what is sexual addiction, what are some of the tools that you can use to combat this debilitating process, how do you work with a partner or your family or your work. You know, just the other day I was talking to a man who was in IT, and he did not, he was not able to abstain from pornography because he sat all day long as the manager of an IT company, a security company actually, and so availability, accessibility was in front of him at all times. And I said, you know, I do not believe you can keep doing this work today. He didn't believe in the 12-step process, and certainly that's his choice. He didn't believe in God or a higher power, and that's one of the reasons that he had so much difficulty with any kind of 12-step program. I felt very flattered that he was there to see me, because I really ascribe to what the 12 steps have to offer, what meetings have to offer, what SA or SAA as a book has to offer, and, of course, the mentoring process of a sponsor. Well, he didn't want any of that. He just wanted to use me, and he was going to use a program called Recovery Nation. Now, if you, too, are having difficulties believing in a higher power, the 12 steps have just rubbed you the wrong way, you may enjoy Recovery Nation. But for him, it wasn't enough accountability to combat that very difficult obsession. And it wasn't just about accountability. What I believe to be true, and certainly Dr. Patrick Carnes talks about this all the time, he says, we are not stronger than our addictions. And he suggests that it is not until you have and are utilizing 5, 6, or 7 tools from the recovery kit toolbox, you know, that may be the 12 steps, that may be mindfulness, that may be meditation, that may be reading, that may be a sponsor, that may be a certified therapist. You put everybody together, and this committee is strong enough to fight and win over the addiction. But what that really means is that you alter your life and you change your lifestyle in such a way that you have replaced the addiction with other situations, other supports that actually provide as much dopamine, serotonin, and some of the other brain chemicals. It provides as much as the actual addiction did at the beginning. So think about that for a minute. Are you utilizing all your resources if you have this illness? I would venture to say, if you're listening to the show, you're one of three types of people. You either are getting some information. You've gone to iTunes, you've plugged in podcasts, and you've plugged in sexual addiction, and I came up. And you want to find out more about it anonymously. Well, you're at the right place. I share the information that I have, and more importantly, I interview the experts in the field all over the world on brain chemistry, and what are treatment programs that work? When do you use self-soothing, mindfulness, meditation? You know, how do you tell your wife or your husband? When do you involve the families? What is disclosure all about? You know, those kinds of questions. So you either are getting information about that, or you are very addicted and wanting help, and you're afraid to come out. You're afraid to expose yourself. And so you're listening to this podcast, and you know that eventually you'll either email me at carolthecoach@AOL.com, you'll go to www.sexhelp.com, one of the leading websites for sexual addiction, or you'll call the show at 646-595-3284. And you will get more information so that you can get the help you deserve. Or you may be like a lot of my clients and a lot of people that know that the more they learn about this illness, the more it reinforces what they're doing right. And you are in full-blown recovery. And you want to find out, is there anything you're missing out there? Are there some tools that you didn't know about? Or maybe you just want to reinforce and validate the behaviors you're already using. Well, I got to tell you, tonight I'm going to be interviewing Sue Neufeld Ellis. She is a CSAT and an RN, and she's going to be talking about the recovery journey of sex, relationships, and romance addictions. And she not only helps clients, but she also helps their partners where infidelity is part of the equation. She knows that this process can help people in recovery from any other compulsive addictive behaviors, and she actually has some tools that she's going to talk about. MBRP. She's going to be talking about what are they and how have these helpful tips on stress management assisted people with addictions all over the world. She's going to be talking about mindfulness. She's going to be talking about how does mindfulness ensure, well, you know, we shouldn't say ensure, but how does it enhance relapse prevention? Who's the process for? You know, how can this process assist people? Is it therapy? Is mindfulness therapy? Is it religious or spiritual? So she's going to be giving us those tools. And it's interesting because I had a man who I just really admire. He's a client. And he just got out of, actually, he got out of the refuge. He also had gone to Gentle Path. And he really enjoyed his mindfulness program that he learned there. And when he came out, he said, Carol, I need to put together a daily activity program that stresses what it is that I need to do to stay in recovery and enhance my life. You know how we've talked about those three circles? There's the outer circle that's your healthy behaviors. Well, he wanted more healthy behaviors. And so I encouraged him. I said, what are you looking at? And he said, well, I'd like to obviously go to SA and SAA. I'd like to attend probably 4, 5, 6 meetings a week. He said, I'd also like to go to Adult Children's of Codependence. I'm sorry, not Adult Children's. I want to go to Codependence Anonymous meetings, but I can't find them, so I'll go to Adult Children's of Alcoholic meetings because they deal with a lot of codependency. And I said, that's a great idea, too. And then he said, I want to take through the local university a mindfulness class because I really believe that the more I stay centered, the more I unbusy myself from life, the less likely I'll be to go on automatic. And when I'm on automatic, what typically ends up happening is that I let other things persuade me into following through with my addiction. And so I 100% agreed with him and said, you're absolutely right. You need to do whatever it takes to get healthy and to practice those tools that you know will make a difference in your life. So I can't wait to talk to Sue about mindfulness, hear about what's available to the general public. And I've got a secret. Hey, she has a special download on her website as a gift to you all. So be listening when she comes on talking about the mindfulness-based relapse prevention, what she calls MBRP. She's also going to be talking about a special download on her website. And, you know, I guarantee you I'm going to be downloading that too. I'm a big download person. I believe in freebies. And, you know, this is a woman who's very talented. She's done a lot of writing. She actually had written, she was one of the originators of the Disclosure, Amends, and Reconciliation process, as explained in the book published by Gentle Path Press called Clergy Sexual Misconduct. She had written a chapter on this process with the clergy wife. And she has a meditation CD she's done with musician Stephen Halperin called Serenity Through Meditation. So she has really worked diligently on providing different tools. And she provides lots of information to healthcare providers all over the country. She's been doing this since about 1989. So she's really, she's one of the founders, I think, of implementing mindfulness in treating addiction. So we look forward to talking with her. Now, you know that you can always email me at carolthecoach@AOL.com, and I will be more than happy to answer your questions on the air, no matter what they are. And you can always call at 646-595-3284 and ask your questions live. Now, I know some of you may worry, oh, my gosh, somebody will recognize me. However, I always say, if somebody's listening to the show, they're just like you and they have some sort of an issue, and if they think they recognize your voice, you can use an anonymous name. You don't have to identify who you are, and we can certainly help. That's what this show's about every Monday night at 9 p.m. And, you know, if you didn't know that you could download the show, you just go to iTunes, put in the podcast part, search for sexual addiction, and the show Strength, Hope, and Recovery comes up with Carol the Coach, and that is me. I'm a certified sexual addictions therapist, and I take my job very, very seriously. I want to help you in any way I can. I provide Skype to people who may not have a certified sexual addictions therapist in their city, and or even in their state or country. And we'll get you to the right people, the closest people, the best workshops, the best treatment centers, the best books. This is a growing field, but it's still relatively new. So the good news is it's easy to be an expert because there's only so much you can read and you learn. And what I love so much about my clients is that they do their bibliotherapy. They've done it before they've even met me. And so together we work diligently on what they need to know to stay healthy and stay in recovery. So I am excited tonight to be talking with Sue Neufeld Ellis, who, as I said, is very much an expert in the field of mindfulness. Sue, is that you on the line?
That's me, Carol. Good evening.
Good evening. And boy, you have made mindfulness a real practice with most of your patients and professionals both. So tell me a little bit about what you consider mindfulness.
Well, a quote from Jon Kabat-Zinn, who's one of the first people actually in the world, and particularly in the United States. He did a lot of the research in the beginning of mindfulness at the University of Massachusetts, and that was between about 1979 to 1994. And he started the first program using mindfulness to deal with chronic pain and physical illnesses such as cancer, et cetera. And so he was the forerunner of what we're doing today, which is mindfulness-based relapse prevention. And I really like a quote from him, which is, "Mindfulness is a way of paying attention on purpose in the present moment and non-judgmentally." So I really like that definition. And it emphasizes acknowledging, feeling, and accepting discomfort as it arises, and understanding the experience more intimately rather than endlessly attempting to run away from it.
Well, and so basically he would be the first to acknowledge that you almost have to embrace it and ask yourself, what does it have to teach you, and how can you surrender to and accept that it is?
That's exactly right. The urges and cravings will change on their own if we give them time to pass. And that's what the mindfulness relapse programs show, is an expansion of that, that people can see more of the big picture instead of giving into one's usual conditioned habitual behavior. Viktor Frankl in 1946 said, "Between stimulus and response, there is a space. In that space is our power to choose our response. And in our response lies our growth and freedom." So I really like that one, too.
Well, I do, too, because that really empowers our clients to know that they have a choice in between the stimulus and the response. You know,
right.
It's not one activates the other, there's a whole gap in there where they can choose a different path.
Right, and the mindfulness practices really, really have people have that experience, and so it is more empowering, and it's not just an automatic reaction.
Well, that makes sense. Now, take it on home, if you will, to somebody who is dealing with sexual addiction. Perhaps it's pornography, and they have had years and years and years of habitually going in the middle of the night and looking at 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 hours of pornography in search of that high that they never can seem to get like they did initially when they first started the practice. So if they were going to use that mode of mindfulness, what might they think initially? What would they think or choose in the gap? And then what would they end up doing differently?
Well, I think one thing that we teach in the classes, too, is a lot of it is distinguishing between physical sensations, emotions, thoughts, and urges. And so what the system teaches is that you become aware of your thoughts, what you're thinking, and also your physical sensations and any emotions that you're feeling. And people are so much more aware of that because in sex addiction or any other addiction, a lot of that stuff goes on subconsciously and unconsciously. So it's also helping unconscious and subconscious things come up into consciousness. So they might just stop and, you know, observe their body and say, what am I feeling right now? And then they feel an urge. And just like you said, they say, what is that urge telling me? What is it that I'm not getting right now? What is underneath that urge? And so rather than do that, they might pick up the phone and call a recovery buddy. Or they might just get up and move and go into another room and pick up something that they like a magazine on boating, or, you know, and so it's changing the patterns that are habituated by getting more in tune to what's going on and breathing. Breathing's also a big part of it.
So then as you teach this process, and if I understand you correctly, you're teaching people to become very aware of what physical sensations are occurring in their body. And
right.
Then what emotions and thoughts they might be having when they feel those physical sensations, and then what urges does it produce?
Right. And it's experientially doing the work when you're not triggered, so to speak, and that's why it's really, really important to have a regular practice. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't even matter, like, it's more important that it's frequent than the time spent in it. Like instead of doing, you know, 30 minutes or an hour, even if you did 10 minutes, you know, five times a day or something, or three times a day, the frequency is more important than the time frame. So it helps people to, when they're not being triggered, to experientially discern between being on automatic pilot and being aware. So it's getting in between that space, and also realizing it's important for people to understand their relapse patterns, like what are their high-risk situations. And that's what we do, is we work a lot with that in the workshops, so that when they're not being triggered, they can really look at and go over what their high-risk situations, what interventions really work for them, and then what are their relapse patterns as well. And so being able to use those things to do the interventions on.
Well, that makes total sense, as well as I know that in the work that I do with people, I'm constantly saying, you know, it is important to know what you do when you're in crisis. But more importantly, you need to get yourself into the pattern of doing these things regularly so that they become a normal part of your day and they won't feel so foreign when you're in the crisis. And that's
right,
what I
exactly.
hear you saying.
Yep.
Yeah, that it's preventive in that people will not experience things in the same way once they're using these tools.
Right.
And it also obviously reduces the amount of stress or urges or cravings or thoughts or emotions because they are utilizing the techniques.
Right. And then if they start to future trip or, you know, do euphoric recall in the past, the intention is to keep also during the workshop and to keep, and this is something, again, that gets habituated, the intention is to keep the discussions during the workshop centered on present experience. And then at key points, relate that experience to their own individual relapse, recovery, craving, and lifestyle change factors. So really noticing what's actually arising in the moment rather than getting lost in interpretations and stories. Because so much of the time, interpretations, stories, judgments are involved, and we aren't even aware we're doing them. And by being able to look at them, we go, gosh, there's a story. Oh, there's a judgment. And so we're more detached from the content. And it's like letting go and beginning again, letting go and beginning again, letting go and beginning again. And to distinguish even finer the initial experience, like the physical sensation, and then the cognitive, which are the thoughts, and then the emotions, which are the yearnings and cravings, and really being able to be much more aware and clear of what's going on. Because a lot of times our thoughts and our emotions control us versus kind of our bigger aware self can control situations by understanding it better and not reacting to it.
Well, I absolutely understand what you mean, but can you, for our listeners, again, break it down into an example that they might be dealing with that has something to do with sexual addiction?
Yeah, okay, so let's say that someone is having an urge to drive down the street where they frequented prostitutes, for example.
Uh-huh.
And this is something, you know, that's really, from a neurobiological standpoint, really etched in the mind, those patterns of, you know, making a turn instead of going the other way, making a turn and driving down that street where they actually did a hookup and would work out. And so as they're turning, maybe they would make a decision to text a friend and text the friend or call the friend versus just get on that street and be habituated into the regular rituals that they're used to. So they just make a different decision at that point to text somebody or to call somebody. And, you know, keep doing that till they get a hold of someone. And then when they talk to someone, that is going to break it. And that's going to break the trance that they're in, and that's going to break their automatic reaction. But if they've already worked with that urge and that craving ahead of time in the, you know, mindfulness sense, then it's not automatic pilot. They go, there it is. And they can see it and feel it in a different way. And so it gives them just that time. And then we also teach to take a breath, and then they have a chance to make a different decision.
That makes total sense. And then you referenced two addictive jargons. You said euphoric recall and future tripping. So for some of the listeners that may not know, go ahead and explain what euphoric recall is, because that occurs in any kind of addiction.
Yeah. Euphoric recall is being able to remember a situation that led to a good feeling. So, you know, for someone who smokes marijuana, let's just say just even getting out the marijuana and getting the bong ready or whatever can start to get them to feel high a little bit, just because of the phenomenon of euphoric recall. Because everything is remembered in our body and in our brain and in our nervous system. And so, you know, that actually could bring that up. Another example for euphoric recall would be, let's say someone saw an attractive woman and then went home and masturbated to her. Let's just say that, the image of her. Then that means that at another time, if they wanted to, they might be able to bring that up in their mind and start having a physiological arousal. Mm-hmm. And so that's what euphoric recall is. And then future tripping, I mean, is just future tripping. It's like thinking ahead and not being in the present. And the thing about the present moment that can be so powerful with urges and cravings, but people have to, I think, you know, really, if they do it with the mindfulness, is to sit down and go through this, is that the cravings and the yearnings pass. And that's what's so amazing, because in the moment often it doesn't feel like it's going to pass. But when they do use the mindfulness-based practices that are specifically researched to deal with urges and cravings. See, that's how it's different than the Jon Kabat-Zinn approach. The Jon Kabat-Zinn with his mindfulness-based, his program's called the Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction. And what that teaches people is how to be with the pain, be with the illness, be with the stress, and the emotions that go along with that. But it's a little more pain and illness and physically focused. Whereas the mindfulness-based relapse prevention is using the relapse prevention research that we already use, that people already use in treatment centers or in outpatient treatment for sex addiction or chemical dependency or gambling or any of those things that have been researched over the years. And they take the relapse prevention. It's more of a cognitive behavioral relapse prevention program that treatment centers do, and then add the mindfulness-based practices to make those things even more expanded and to get even more awareness and insight of those patterns and the urges and cravings and what's really going on underneath them.
Sure that you've worked with people in the workshops and your own personal clients that, you know, they actually do call a friend, or they'll say miraculously, oh, my gosh, I was just ready to act out and my sponsor called me, or a sponsee called me.
Uh-huh.
And they really feel like that's some sort of spiritual intervention, and it could
right.
be.
Yep, yep.
But then, given a few more moments, that craving begins again, and the second time around, they give in to it. They don't practice the mindfulness to know this too shall pass, or
right.
these urges and cravings will dissipate, or they'll shift into something a lot more workable.
Right.
And so you're saying that so much of what you teach is so that they will have lots of different tools in their tool belt so that they can utilize several things if they need to fight off the urges and cravings, or maybe fight is the wrong word. Surrender to them in a new and different way.
Yeah, it's that letting go and beginning again, letting go and beginning again. And it's actually proactive instead of reactive. And that's kind of the focus, is to keep thinking proactive instead of reactive. And, you know, in recovery, nothing's 100%. And so just like you're saying, Carol, it's really true. This is just expanded practices, expanded tools and things to integrate and practice in any recovery program. And, again, one of the key points is to, you know, do it on a regular basis. So it becomes just like riding a bicycle, you know, that the more we ride it, the more comfortable we get and know what we're doing. And even if we put it down for a year or two, if we get back on it, there it is. And that's why it's really important to have as much as possible to integrate in a regular mindfulness practice, so that instead of the old neurobiological track, which is the addiction, the automatic, the reactive, then it starts to switch over to the new one. You know, and the brain research is showing us that this can happen. You know, it's like taking out the old program and putting in a new program. And the research, this was developed by the Addictive Behavior Research Center at the University of Washington here in Washington State. And so it has been researched for efficiency. And what they found in their studies, which was so interesting, I think, is that the short-term regular treatment, which is really good, but sometimes is more of aversion therapy and pushing it away and that kind of thing, that that's really good at the beginning of recovery, but that as in a longer term, the mindfulness practices were very important in the research. When those were being integrated, they said it was really, really helping with people being able to have longer periods of sobriety or total sobriety altogether. Now, this isn't research on sex and love addiction, because as far as I know, I'm the only person that is doing this at this time. But this is research on people recovering from chemical dependency and drug addiction.
Well, yes, and I'm curious, Sue, if people wanted to get a hold of you, what is the address of your website, as well as what are the names of your workshops that you do run, since you are one of the few people to do any kind of work like this for sexual addiction?
Right. Well, my website is quantumhealing.us, and you can just email me there. So it's Sue, S-U-E, at quantum, Q-U-A-N-T-U-M, healing, healing.us. Sue at quantumhealing.us. And also, if you do visit the website, on the home page, right up at the top, it'll say 25 stress management tips. And that's my gift to the listeners today, to be able to, you just click that, and there's an article on stress management. And this can be, this is applied specifically for sex and relationship addiction and partners, but it can be applied to anyone that wants to reduce stress. And there's 25 tips there on ways to help people integrate new things into their life as a lifestyle change in dealing with stress if they're interested.
That just sounds fantastic. Now, you mentioned partners, and so many of our listeners our partners. You know, they have been so traumatized themselves, and of course they have their own urges and cravings to check cell phones and act out by following or GPSing, and you know, they'll have stopped for a while and then they start back up. So tell me what kind of work you do with the partners. What exercises might you give them?
Well, with the partners, one reason I wrote that in there, in particular for the flyers, was that increased awareness of individual relapse patterns, triggers, and automatic reactions, and habitual patterns that often cause discomfort. So, in other words, just like the urges and cravings of, let's say, the sex or relationship addict, with the partner, often it's this, and for different partners it's different, of course, but often there's this overreactive and very large sense of anxiety, of fear, of feeling that there's a loss of control. And that's often, in my experience, why partners do the behaviors that they do. They're like anxiety reducing and gives them a sense of control and knowledge, and rather it does or not, that's what I think those urges and cravings are after, is to try to reduce that kind of discomfort. So to be able to use the mindfulness-based practices, again, to deal with the anxiety and depression or whatever it is that's going on, the anger, to know that there is a choice instead of automatically reacting. Like sometimes they're going to, you know, and they're just going to, you know, it's just going to happen. But other times, if they do it on a regular basis, it actually has them relate differently to the anxiety, to the triggers, and to bring the volume of those things down with the practices. And there's specific practices. So for each class, well, there's a couple ways of doing it. It's like there's weekend intensives, of which I have a women's intensive on Saturday and Sunday, May 18th and 19th, and then a men's on Saturday and Sunday, June 1st and 2nd. And we actually go all day long. And then also there's in Washington here, there's an ongoing eight-week workshop. And each of those days and each of those hours of the workshop that's where you practice and you learn these practices. And there's also, after the workshops, there's ways to access these practices. So besides just doing them yourself, you could listen to a recording on helping you go through that. And also, there's it's like it's not, these are not about storytelling, telling your story,
mm-hmm.
or it's just about saying what is your discomfort that you want to work on. And then we do the individual mindfulness practices, and then people share their experience of what happened for them. And we do what's called inquiry. So there's not really processing or therapy. It's not therapy. It's skill building in the workshop. And the inquiry are things like questions I would ask like, is that familiar for you? How does it feel in your body right now? How did you relate to what you just experienced? So it's all about coming back to the present moment. And when the present moment is practiced, then it's a lot easier, a lot more automatic to not have to go into the past, not have to go in the future, but just deal with what's happening for you right in that moment.
Now, let me ask you, you know, obviously you asked three very important questions. You asked how did that feel in your body,
mm-hmm.
and you asked how did, what were the other two, how did that?
I know, I'm trying to think. I just kind of said it automatically.
Well, I'm wondering what a normal workshop attendee might say. What might they say to how does that feel in the body?
Well, we spend a lot of time, which is so interesting, because a lot of time addictive behaviors are not about being in your body. So one
okay.
thing that's really, really, is interesting is people really get to know themselves more. So they might say, okay, what's in my body? Well, let's see, I'm feeling something in my upper stomach, mm-hmm. and I'm not quite sure what it is, but I think it might be anxiety, but I'm not sure. You know, and so it's that kind of thing. They just get to know more what the body is telling them. And so then the chances are if they practice that, then the next time they're beginning to feel urges or cravings, they stop, and that's what they do. They shut their eyes and they say, what am I feeling in my body? And they go, oh, yeah, that's right. From the workshop and from the practice, that was anxiety. And then it's like, okay, so what is that anxiety telling me? You know, what's underneath that anxiety? All right, what's underneath that anxiety is that my boss gave me not so good an evaluation, and I feel scared about that. And then it would be like, okay, so what are you going to do with that? And so it'd be, well, I'm going to breathe, or I'm going to talk to someone about it, or I'm going to use some of the other exercises to be with that anxiety and to really to be in a different way with that discomfort and not having to particularly do anything about it.
And that
and
really
what they
is
find
empowering.
Is that it goes. Yeah, it leads.
Mm-hmm. Well, this must be exciting work for you because not only do you give people the skills that they need, but you get to see immediately the benefits that occur when they begin to use them, no matter whether they're beginners, intermediates, or advanced.
Right. That's exactly right. I mean, it's just so so interesting to see, like with some in one particular case, it was like this person was having fear, and the
mm-hmm.
fear just passed away. It just like was gone.
Mm-hmm.
And then what was so interesting that in the next exercise, which was, you know, still being with discomfort, all of a sudden they said, oh, my gosh, at the end of this exercise, I began to feel just a little glimpse, just a coming and going of joy and happiness.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so amazing to them how one minute the fear was there and it was gone, and then they did another exercise and there was the joy and happiness. And that even the joy and happiness came and went. So it's all about that none of this is permanent.
Well, that makes sense. And, you know, again, you can strengthen what you need by utilizing it and practicing it regularly. So would you say this is therapy, this mindfulness training is therapy?
No, it's balancing acceptance and action. It's not a passive thing either. It's balancing acceptance and action. And it's not therapy because we're staying in the moment and we're doing what's called inquiry. So, again, it's not about, you know, taking something and trying to do an intervention and making it different. It's just being with what is and experiencing that, and then being able to share that with others. And the thing is, the sharing with others is so interesting because people get just as much from other people in the workshops, like reaction to what, you know, they're dealing with and their experience, as they do their own. And that's what makes it so rich. And actually, what I do is I do ask people that come to the workshops, they need to be either in counseling or therapy themselves, be in treatment or, you know, an aftercare program, or be in outpatient therapy of some sort, and or have a very strong, you know, be able to tell me and show me they have a very strong recovery program with support. Because like with anything, you never can, you know, you never know for sure what's going to come up. And I'm not their therapist. I'm their workshop facilitator.
Right.
And it is, again, skill-building practices. But I think people in recovery really need some kind of support to be able to continue looking at what's coming up for them.
Sure. That makes total sense. Now, would you, if somebody called you and wanted to take this workshop and they did not have a therapist, would you be able to assist them in finding somebody in their area?
Definitely. Definitely. I do that all the time. Because people here in Washington, you know, move all over the United States. And I always, if they want that, of course, I always hook them up with a number of choices. And then, you know, I know when my clients, before they leave, I really have them, you know, have picked a therapist and are working with someone to make the transfer. But, no, that's really doable. I could do that, you know, all over the world, particularly with sex and love addiction and partners.
So you find that love addiction, clients that may have love addiction that, you know, just are not fulfilled unless they're with somebody and they're constantly in pursuit of them, they really respond to this mindfulness training.
Yes, right, both. Romance, relationships, sex addiction, yes, it's for everybody. And I did go ahead and have separate groups, at least for the intensives, for the women and the men so that they could feel safe depending, you know, on what they're dealing with. But also in the group, the weekly group, which is an eight-week group, 2 hours a week, it is mixed. So always assessing if people feel, because sometimes partners don't, you know, feel safe with other recovering sex addicts, and then sex addicts don't feel safe with the partners and whatever. And so I'm always very well, I'm assessing each person for their level of comfortability and their level of support so that people can really, you know, feel safe.
Well, I am talking with Sue Neufeld Ellis, and she can be reached at sue@quantum, and that's Quantum Healing. .us, and she provides workshops. You've got several coming up just in the next 2 months.
Yes.
She provides workshops on this MBRP, which is mindfulness-based relapse prevention. And, you know, one of the things that I hear in your voice is that you're very compassionate. You're very non-judgmental. People can come in there with any issues and feel safe figuring out how they can shift their feelings, thoughts, and emotions into different reactions.
Now, that's a great way to say it, Carol.
thank you. You know,
yeah.
I think I understand what the components of your workshops are, but can you just give people a breakdown on what they can expect?
Yes. Again, we either put it into 2 days or, again, 2 hours over 8 weeks. And session one is particularly focused on what is mindfulness and also automatic pilot and relapse. How does automatic and pilot and relapse work? And again, it's very experiential. So we do some talking. I do some, talking about what these things are, but it's just even, and people, of course, have time to ask questions, and, you know, it's no rush. We just take our time and just enjoy. And so we do spend the first session on what is mindfulness, and also we introduce the body scan, and this is one of the main practices to be aware of body sensations and what it means to connect with them in a present moment experience. And it's an openness and curiosity toward all experiences versus expectations about what one should or shouldn't experience. So we link paying attention to actual physical experiences and experiences of reactivity, cravings, and urges. So that would be session one. And session two is becoming more aware now of the triggers and the cravings and begin to shift relationship to them, recognizing them as experiences to acknowledge and work with. And this is observing how the thoughts, emotions, physical sensations, and urges react in response to the interpretation of it. So a lot of times our interpretation and our judgments and our criticisms is actually causing a lot of the discomfort. And these exercises, these practices in session two really help people see that experientially. And so that's, you know, very powerful for most people. And they practice staying present with and observing those experiences of craving and urges. But now we frame it with kindness and curiosity rather than engaging in reactive or resistant behavior. So surrounding it with this curiosity and asking questions about it.
Right.
And we begin to look beneath the craving for underlying needs, like, oh, we have to have a relief from difficult emotions or a desire for peace and freedom. So just, again, getting a lot better at saying, what are the cravings and the urges? What is the addiction really? What needs are underneath that instead of just staying on the surface with it? And also there's some stabilizing and grounded practices, which are very, very helpful too. That's session two. And then session three is, how do we bring mindfulness into daily life? Hearing, and how do we use the hearing to heighten our awareness? You know, bringing attention to activities in which we're constantly engaged, but often we don't have awareness during our day. And noticing sounds and events that arise,
right,
and then are in awareness, and then they go away. We use breathing, and also besides the breath meditation, there's a meditation that's called the sober breathing space, which is a way to stop automatically reacting. And then session four is mindfulness in high-risk situations and looking at individual and common relapse risks, like what are high-risk situations and how can we look at those and begin to develop awareness of those, of each person's individual unique risk patterns.
Mm-hmm.
We also do walking meditations and eating meditations so that, again, we're beginning to bring that into our daily life and not making... Some people just sit and become mindful, but then they don't bring it into their daily life. And so with this, we're trying to do both, to do all of it. And then seeing thoughts as thoughts and just seeing that our mind thinks, that's what our mind does, but that those thoughts don't have to control our reality all the time like they do. And even recognizing judgment is yet another thought. So,
find judgment to be a prevalent thought for any addict or any partner or anybody who really questions their love addiction. So I can imagine that this is a thought that you're really helping people with that comes up all the time.
Right. And we also spend sessions on self-care and lifestyle balance, which for me, if I could take the word recovery and make it into one word, it would be balance. And I know, you know, gosh, self-care is just so important for recovering addicts and their partners. Self-care is just paramount in a really healthy recovery. So we spend time practicing kindness toward ourselves and others. That's part of session seven. And just observing what arises in the practice with openness and compassion, you know, instead of always pushing it away and being judgmental. Because we can always, you know, push away and be judgmental. That we know how to do. But really, really practicing observing with openness and compassion and some kindness. Because, you know, so much about you know, sex addiction and partners and stuff, is there's self-loathing, there's shame, there's guilt, you know, all of those things, and just, you know, looking at them and being aware of them in a whole different way and working with them in a different way. And noticing, you know, depleting versus nourishing activities. We have a whole worksheet and a whole session on that, noticing the balance between depleting and nourishing activities, and the importance of, you know, making commitments to include nourishing activities, and how we relate to the depleting ones, and how we can make them more or less depleting, and how we show up for the nourishing ones, and how can we increase their value. And again, it's not judging the depleting ones as being bad, it's just looking at it, looking at both of them, the nourishing and the depleting, with more awareness and new eyes, and just getting more insights from them.
Well, this absolutely sounds amazing. Now, I have one last question for you, and because so many people are divided into two camps. One is the group of clients that absolutely need a higher power to assist them in recovery and in mindfulness and in meditation. And then it's the other camp that says, you know, I just don't buy the higher power concept. So is mindfulness, is this, you know, MBRP,
yeah,
is it spiritual or religious?
No, it's not. What it is it's mindfulness-based practices along with researched relapse prevention, Western psychology research, which is Western psychology practices. So it's cognitive behavioral therapy, like someone that would just be going to a therapist and identifying, you know, what are the things I want to work on and how can I do it differently. And then the practices show that in a more expanded way. But it is not religious, it's not spiritual, but certainly it's allowed. So if someone is having an experience and they have a religious or spiritual experience, that's certainly okay. And if they want to share about it, we certainly want to hear about that in the same inquiry way that we would deal with any other issue in the workshop. So it certainly can be that individual person's own path. But other than that, no, it is not religious or spiritual at all.
Okay. Well, I think you have absolutely answered all of my questions. So, again, one more time, give them your email if they are interested in your workshop, as well as, obviously, they need to go for that free download and take a look at your website. I will be on that website immediately getting those tips. So give them the information.
So it's sue@quantumhealing.us, S-U-E at Q-U-A-N, I just forgot how to spell my own website, Q-U-A-N,
T-U-M,
T-U-M-H-E-A-L-I-N-G .us, sue@quantumhealing.us. And thank you so much for having me tonight, Carol. I really appreciate it. This is really fun.
Well, I so appreciate all that you're doing, and, you know, these are measurable things that you can do on a daily basis. I mean, they're good for anybody, but certainly for people in recovery that have that self-loathing and need to quiet those thoughts and shift them into a new energy. I just so admire the work you're doing. Thanks again.
Okay, thanks, Carol. You take care.
You too.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. Well, you are listening to Strength, Hope, and Recovery. This is Carol the Coach, and this is the show on sexual addiction where we learn tools and learn from the experts what you can do to shift how you feel about yourself and move into a recovery process where you're in control, where you have emotional regulation that you feel good about, and where you make healthy and smart choices. So I really appreciated Sue's conversation tonight. Now, as I say to all of you every week, that there will only be one of you at all times, so I fearlessly want you to have the courage to be yourself. Next week, we'll be talking with Ken Adams, who's renowned in the field of sexual addiction. So I'll see you next week, and make it a good one.